Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa. Steve Bynum has been the senior producer for Worldviews, a global affairs program on Chicago Public Radio, WBEZ. We met at a monastery a number of years ago, and our conversations have explored the challenges to democracy, culture, and communities, given both the political leadership and the habits of mind in both Canada and the United States of America. In this podcast, we explore questions of race, power, and privilege, questions shaking the foundations of our civil society. Steve grew up on the west side of Chicago. He received a football scholarship to Notre Dame and has a stellar journalistic record. A small, intimate storefront church was central to his formation. And in more recent years, he has engaged the gifts of the Orthodox Church that, of course, has deep roots in Africa and the Levant long before it migrated to Europe. Our conversation begins with his family of blessed memory in Memphis, Tennessee, and their migration to Chicago. Grandparents, aunts, and uncles were all laid to rest in a small town cemetery, a pilgrimage site for Steve. They are his most intimate saints and martyrs. We recorded our conversation in the late fall, prior to the crisis shaking both our countries. In listening to it to prepare this podcast, I was struck at how it has enlarged what I hear in the voices of Steve's brothers and sisters, and mine, and of our First Peoples in Canada. Moving through the prism of slavery and freed of the luxury of hatred, the last bonds that hold all victims, it speaks to the salvation offered to those of us who are privileged. Are we ready to receive it? Ready to step out of the prison of privilege, the precincts we are blind to? Welcome to our conversation.
Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa.
Steve, I've always found your reflections on your home and native land, the country that you and your people have built, along with others, very provocative. I know that you also, as a real American, understand that even when you have a president who is perhaps problematic, he still remains your president. And I've appreciated that. I wanted to use this opportunity we have to talk to have you speak a little bit about what's going on in the United States. Most Canadians watch the news. They see lots of American news. But we don't often understand what's behind this. So I think of what is at work here. I think, as you and I have talked in the past, concerns that we share about where the evangelical church is in all of this, what the implications are for the black community, for women's issues, a whole range of things. So what's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on in your beautiful country?
I remember the first time that I listened to What's Going On by Marvin Gaye. I was sitting downstairs in my basement and didn't realize what a piece of art it was. And it was sort of seamless, like Sgt. Pepper's. And his scream and his lament and his sorrow and his hope and his resistance in that album moves me to this day, and I take so much from it when I think about the questions you've put before me. You've given me a lot to chew on, so let's start with the first thing you said when you said, my country. So many would say, well, isn't it Africa? But you said, no, your country, which you built. And I'm glad that you said that because I was recently in Memphis, Tennessee, my ancestral city, my mother and my father's family, are from a sleepy town north of Memphis called Arlington and the surrounding areas. And
they moved north and brought you north?
They brought my mother north.
With the Great Migration.
In the Great Migration in the 1950s. My father came to Chicago when he graduated from school, from college. He went to Philander Smith, historically black college, because he couldn't go anywhere else, certainly. And for that reason, so much of my thinking is tethered in my ancestral home of Memphis, Tennessee, because my maternal grandmother is one of 14 children. And I remember all of them except for the one who passed away when I was 2 years old. I can tell you their names. Catherine, we called her Catherine. Lydia, called her Sugar. Mm-hmm. Fanny Francis, we called her Toot. My Aunt Lilybelle. And there was Vera Ann. She passed away when I was two. All I have of her is a photo of her, maybe a few months before she passed from cancer. Then you have the sons. There's George, called him Manny. James, we called him Uncle Bus. Uncle Morris. Uncle Floyd, the baby. And then Uncle Charlie, Charlie Jr., son of Charlie Henry McGuire and his wife, Addie Blanche, who was also a daughter by that name that I left out. And then there's Marie, who was my grandmother's closest friend, who passed away from cancer in 1989 and began a descent for my grandmother as she lost her husband a few years later and three of her brothers, two within a month of one another. And she couldn't even enjoy the birth of my son because one of her sisters passed away right around that time. I have to bring them up because they are my arc. I never had a crossword towards them or from them. They were sweet, even the boys. You could describe them all as sweet. They all went and served in the army, served and fought for a country in which they did not have the rights of others, and yet they served. My grandfather, he served. He and his brother served in the South Pacific, where they weren't allowed to carry a firearm, you see. They drove supply trucks, and my great uncles were cooks because that was all they could do. The exception of my great aunt's husband, who served in Europe. I believe he was in Patton's army. And the only reason why he was able to serve is because he was very fair skinned. I think about them frequently because I use them as my moral compass. Not only in my own personal behavior, but in how I raise my family, and most importantly, to your question, how I think about America.
They are your moral compass.
They're my moral compass because as I think about what it means to be, I will say, a citizen of the United States, to say I'm an American is an insult to our brothers and sisters in Mexico and Canada. We're all Americans on this continent. But in my younger years, I only saw my existence, my literal existence, through the prism of how white people viewed me or how I would function in white society. And so, as a result, I did not spend enough attention to myself. I did not spend enough attention on my rich, textured history, be it culturally as an African American or a part of the Africa diaspora, and then also as a member of the McGuire family. And so as a result, you focus on what history tells you. And as you know, history can be very subjective, or always is. And as a result, I was always looking outward. And so my emotions were always projecting outward, while at the same time I'm internalizing doing a lot of the self-victimization that marginalized people do. And then when I became older, as my ancestors began to pass away, I became really reflective. And my anger then turned to curiosity. I wanted to know more about who I was and who I am, or to know who I am through who I was even before I was born. And so symbolically, when I'm in Memphis at one of my cousins' homes on their land, there are about almost, I think, 14 trees. They look like redwoods, but they aren't. And they're about 70, 80 feet high. And when I see those trees, I see each one of my great aunts and uncles and my grandparents. And it reminds me that the roots are deep and lasting. And as resilient as these trees are, so am I. So now I look at, first thing you said, asking me to speak for my people. I know you personally, so I know you don't mean it in a racist or in a patronizing manner, but in the United States, frequently we are asked to speak for our people and our experience as if we all are the repository of all knowledge about all African Americans and whoever lived in the United States to this day. And so my younger self would have taken offense. My older self, having some wisdom, I see it as an opportunity to talk about a group that I feel are the salvation of the United States. Mm. Because we as a people, being a Southern church-based culture, have done more to exemplify God's love and his truth and his mercy and his justice than any group of people that have ever existed in the United States. Through our suffering and our stripes, we heal this country. Through our work and our labor and our travails, we build this country. And I say it in the present tense, not built. We build it. We save it. We grow it. And through our story, we give color, texture, context, and depth to the American story. And so I feel that way about my Orthodox faith. I see them running parallel, hand in hand. That coming into the Orthodox faith has brought depth and texture and context to my walk with God that I never would have had. I am closer to Africa now than I am Orthodox than I ever was before.
Large part of Orthodoxy comes from Africa.
Which I did not know.
Yeah.
And it is important. I know we're in a moment of hyper-nationalism, and I know of the dangers of it, and you've spoken about it and wrote about it and lectured about it. But identity does matter. And I don't want us to lose that, because to see myself in the church gives me strength. It gives me a power. It gives me the courage to live a full life in Christ, which I could not do when it was quote unquote the white man's religion that was enforced upon us and used as a way to pacify us in order to make better slaves of us. I am a slave, but I am a slave to Christ and his gospel. And therefore I am free. I did not fully understand that until I became Orthodox. So, to your second point, real Americans. You said being a real American, I appreciate the compliment. I have to talk about that a little bit. we find ourselves in a moment where what it means to be a real American, once defined, then became redefined, now we're going back to the future, where it's a retro definition that real American means white. Real American means extractive. Real American means insular. Real American means arrogant. Real American means that exceptionalism rules at the expense of common sense and wisdom. And so now, 240 plus years or so after this grand experiment began, in a small laboratory, and the researchers and the theorists were white male property owners. And they wrote glowing and flowery words, words that I wish I could have internalized when I was young. I could not, because everything and anything I learned about myself was through the prism of being a slave, a victim, a problem. W.B. Du Bois talked about that. When he'll ask a white person, think about this. What would it feel like if existentially you were a problem to the country you call your home? And that's how you identify yourself. And that's how you think about yourself. Now notice that in this time, I have not spoken at all about lynchings or slavery as it functioned in Jim Crow and such. And I won't. We all know that history. I'm not speaking to you today to talk about what was done to us. I'm here to talk about what we are going to do for, what we have done and will do for America and for ourselves. Because we have to stop being victims. We must stop being victims. We have to unlearn all that we have learned in order to move forward. We have spent too much time focusing on what was done to us with our hands out, saying, please, please, please give us what we're due. Please, please, please acknowledge me. Please, please, please see me. We may never be seen, but we can be heard. We may never be loved, but we can be present. Frederick Douglass said that power concedes nothing without a demand. We have to stop behaving as if though we don't belong. We have to claim our rightful place with all due deference and respect to our indigenous brothers and sisters who had the land taken from them, who had their culture robbed from them. And I believe until we make peace with them and to make peace with that crime, this continent will never truly know peace or harmony or justice. That said, every stone, every road has our blood in it. And rather than beg, plead, or request, we must stake our claim to what is ours. We are in the DNA of this country. And to ask for permission is as insane as if I were to say my arm needs permission to be a part of my body. It is. So, real American, as far as I'm concerned, has little to do with claim of land or property or an identity. And it has more to do with the ongoing struggle for justice, as is the case in here in Canada. Canadians, as well as they have done with their egalitarian project, they have some reconciliation to do themselves. And in some cases, were more harsh than we were in the States, especially what happened to Central and Eastern Europeans after World War I, where they were held in concentration camps in Canada. Obviously, what has happened, what is happening with Indigenous people, what did happen, and what tends to still happen with the French Canadians in Quebec. So, I mean, if you go to Central and South America, the scars of colonialism and self-hatred and assimilation are still wreaking havoc. So there's a lot of work to do. So real American has to have a more global meaning. Real American means that we erase borders. Now, I may be accused, well, every country has to have borders. Well, no, every country does not have to have the borders I'm speaking about. And so I think slowly but surely we're realizing that, and we're talking to each other in ways that we haven't before, in spite of the difficulties that we face now. And when we can say real American and not in opposition to or comparison to or comparing it to some other standard, I think we will gain even more power. So, and then finally, as I look at what's happening politically here, and I mean the United States, I see a couple of things going on. I see, obviously, the reactionary politics of populism and nationalism and such, and ethnocentrism and racial purity and all of that. But what I also see is I see inner struggles in communities of color. On my show Worldview, we've been interviewing so many people and families who've talked about struggles within immigrant communities, especially generationally, about what it means to be Indo, what it means to be Chinese, what it means to be Mexican. And those definitions are being torn apart and put back together as well. The struggle between one generation that says the most important thing is to come to this country, assimilate to the white Anglo-Saxon standard, assimilate into a capitalist model of success, forget who we are, don't speak your language, and assimilate. Meantime, they're burning crosses on our front lawns. These are things that I'm hearing now from the older generation because it was impolite to talk about these things, because that violates a rule of assimilation for immigrants. And now I'm getting people in their 60s and 70s who are talking about the fact that when we came to this country in the 50s, 60s, and 70s through the 80s, there were cross burnings. We also were targeted and profiled by police. They feel more comfortable telling those stories because their young people are demanding that they do, because they would lose their young people otherwise. And so now I am not so traumatized by having the talk with my son, my adult son, or when he was a young boy, about the things you cannot do as an African-American male if you want to survive an encounter with the police. And I felt such anger and shame. No. Now I understand that I am empowering him. I am giving him the tools in order to stake his claim in this world. Because these little roadblocks that used to get in our way, like the prison industrial complex, the school to prison pipeline in schools, you name it, the glass ceiling, these are things that exist. But they are obstacles. And I came to this conclusion because, being Orthodox, I learned that you need the obstacles. They are necessary for your growth. You cannot progress and grow in the faith, and you cannot draw closer to God without struggle. So who am I to expect a life of comfort, a life without struggle. My people are holy. They are sanctified because of their struggle. They are saints and martyrs, and I venerate them, and I honor them, and I will not allow anger to belittle their sacrifice and their lives and what they gave to me and continue to give to me as I extend my heart to them in prayer, in memory, and in hope. And that hope is manifest in what I tell my children and what I'm talking to you about right now.
You said they are the salvation of the United States. How so? You know the word salvation is a lovely Greek word. We translate it soterios. Mm-hmm. Rescue. Implied healing.
Salvation is a noun, a verb, an adjective, an adverb, you name it. And in all those ways, we are the salvation of this country, America, the United States. Because what I have learned in my latter days and my walk with God is that salvation is not about paying off a debt. Salvation is not about moral behavior. Salvation is not about avoiding punishment. Salvation, at its core, is the moment and those moments when we come back to ourselves, when we return to ourselves, when we stop wandering in a foreign land and we return home to our loving Father. I did not understand the prodigal son until I became Orthodox. Before, the prodigal son was this wayward kid, snot-nosed punk, who's grabbed all his father's dough, went out there, had a great time, and then when he was flat broke, then he decides to come home. And it was about the son. I did not realize that truly the prodigal son is about the father, the loving father, who longingly waits at the gate, begging, pleading for his child to return to himself and come home, which is why he said to the son who was angered by this,
the older son,
I have done everything you ever asked of me. I have been obedient. I served. You don't think I wanted to go running out and gallivanting and having fun and partying? No, I didn't. I stayed. And now he comes back and you just roll out the red carpet? And the father, almost humorously, as Christ would chuckle to himself when his disciples would ask him really silly questions, because I used to think our Lord was admonishing the disciples. No, he was saying, oh, my child, let me tell you. And so the father tells the son, and I'm paraphrasing all of this, oh, my beloved, all that I have, all that I am, has been, will be yours. Where is your generosity? Where is your love? You are lost. Because my son, your brother, was lost, and he found himself, and he's come back to us. Kill the fatted calf. It's nothing. Take all my money. It's nothing. Take the land. You want it? Take it. I don't care. Have it all. Is that what you care about? No. So when I knew that my father in heaven was longing for me, crying for me, sent his only begotten son for me because he was desperate to have me back, desperate for me to come to myself, my true human nature, as he intended, Oh, all that I do, all that I care to do is to be close to this parent who loves me so, who's so loving and just to me. Why would I hurt him? So salvation through my people is what Gandhi tried to show the British, what King tried to show Bull Connor. We will help our sick brothers by helping them see themselves. We will bring them back to themselves through our suffering and make them whole.
So Gandhi's comment that the suffering of the peoples on the subcontinent, as significant as that is not nearly as deep as the suffering in the mind of the British colonial ruler.
That's right. Because there's something that happens to us when we submit to the darker parts of our nature, when we turn away from God, from love, from communion, from light. We feel the need to consume because there's a void. And so we think that land, riches, or forcing the submission of another will fill that void. That greatness is defined by empire, by control. We have wreaked havoc upon our earth. We have wreaked havoc upon ourselves because our relationships are extractive. What can I take from you? Or what can you give me? Right? Relationships must be transformational. That word metanoia, which is poorly translated into English because there's really no good translation from the Greek, it doesn't mean repentance. It's part of it. Metanoia, the best translation I've found is to transform, to change the inner eye of the soul or the heart. Not even the heart, the inner eye, the gateway. The African peoples, as we were scattered across this planet, your mother, because Africa is your mother, my mother. When we rape our mother, when we pillage and disrespect our mother, we have lost ourselves. We must make peace with our mother. There is a, I can't describe it, there's a force within the African people that I can't describe. And I feel it when I hear the drum. I feel it when I hear us wail. I feel it when we laugh, the way we laugh, how we sing, how we love, how we move. That does not exist in any other people. Why? Because we are the mother. There is a reason when soldiers die on a battlefield, they cry out for their mothers as they leave this world. They wail for their mothers, not their fathers. A dear friend of mine once said that if you want to solve the problems from a policy perspective, you solve it for Black people. If you solve the education problem for Black people, you will solve it for everyone. If you solve the poverty problem for Black people, you will solve it for everyone. If you solve connectivity issues, you name it. If you solve it for them, you solve it for everyone. Why? Because if you look at the heart of history in the United States, most of what has transpired, urban policy, the development of cities, the industrial age, you name it. You can see at various points where African peoples, whether it's denying them or exploiting them, were at the heart of this development, of this quote unquote evolution. And so let's pick any point in history, and I can point you directly to how the African peoples did and do play a part in it. So yes, the salvation of the United States comes through Africa and its people, her children. We're all children of Africa. But I mean in this epoch. One example I learned through the excellent podcast 1619, which commemorates the 400th anniversary of the first slave arriving in Jamestown. And Nicole Hannah-Jones, the person who produced this project, talks about that when she says, let's look at this real resistance to universal health care. What is at the basis of that? It comes from this history of slavery, and that from that history and the other people who came to this country who were not white, that somehow or another, they are not worthy of, or they are somehow, there's something deceptive about those people. There's something just innately immoral, and that they must be civilized and trained and schooled in order to be full human beings. And so after emancipation, the Freedmen's Bureau, the bureau that was set up for Reconstruction because of an outbreak of disease, smallpox and other diseases, there was a concern that that disease would spread to the general white population. And so there was an idea to create universal health care for the former slaves that was flat out rejected because the idea of giving those undeserving people health care was a bridge too far. As a matter of fact, it was supposed to be the model for universal health care for everyone. Whites at the time, in the South especially, but in the North, would rather not have health care at all than to see those people receive it. It's the same thing with the welfare state. So many ways that we could better support populations, uplift populations, and generate innovation, creativity. We don't do it because there's this idea that if those people have it, then I don't want it. Even though there are more white people on welfare than black people, even though more white people are strung out on drugs, and in certain categories, even by percentage, that may be the case. Does not matter. We do care about drug addiction now, by the way, because of the opioid crisis. Because now white people are addicted. And so now we care. We have to do something. We have to have treatment. We have to think about criminal reform, criminal justice reform. Amen. I agree with that. Where was this ingenuity 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago when black men and women, but specifically black men, were snatched out of their communities, decimating those communities, literally decimating those communities, so that you had a generation of men without a father, without support, and another generation and another generation, or putting conditions on support that you can receive this support, but there cannot be a man or a husband in the home. Who would design policies like that with intentionality?
It replicated slavery.
It's mind-boggling to me. And so, going forward, if we're going to talk about a future where black people and other people of color are able to rise, we have to be bold in just stating these truths and not be afraid of offending someone. And we can't be afraid of hearing things that we might feel are ignorant or uninformed. And we can't assume the worst possible motives behind things we hear. We have to stop being so sensitive. We can't let anxiety rule our discourse and dialogue. As a friend shared with me recently, I'm sitting over there. The hard work is not in talking to white people. The hard work is talking to black people. That's the hard work. Because we have to change as well. We have to redefine the conversation as well. We have to get outside of our little silos and bubbles and realize that there's a world out there and there are resources and people who want to join us. And we cannot limit the struggle simply based on skin color. Because let me tell you, I feel more comfortable in a room full of white Southerners than I will ever feel in a room with East Coast black bourgeoisie. I can talk to Southerners. We love the same food. We have the same cultural background. We have the same sense of morality, same sense of family. I love being around white Southerners. I don't fear them. And so, yeah, I may have to initially go out of my way to let them know that you have nothing to fear in me. And there was a time where I would have thought that, how, I will not degrade myself or lower myself to that. But you know what? I don't feel that way anymore, because that's ego. I want to connect to you. I want to touch you. I want us to understand one another. I want us to bond. I want us to break bread and share stories about our families and our lives and our hopes and our dreams, so that you know that our commonalities are deep.
And that's much easier to do with white Southerners than East or West Coast bourgeoisie.
Absolutely. Oh, without question. You kidding me? Our reverence for history we share. Our reverence for family. And family's extended family. See, the bourgeoisie, you know, the elites, be they white or black, you know, it's all about your nuclear family and sending them to college and getting them prepared to take their place, you know, in the capitalist project. White picket fence, nice car, all of that. No. Southerners, they go to college, great, but you know what? Don't forget yourself. Don't get too big for your britches. I heard that all the time from my elders. The greatest compliment my grandfather, my father's father, gave to me, I called him on the phone. He was dying from cancer. We didn't know how close he was to death at the time. He said, "Boy, you know what I tell your grandma all the time and other people? Every time I get off the phone with you, I say, you know that Steve, he's got old folks sense." That was the greatest compliment I ever received. And he said, "What I like about you, Steve, is that you've got horse sense. I know a lot of people with book sense. They ain't got no horse sense. You've got horse sense. I'm not worried about you." And then he died 2 weeks later. So that conversation has to be had within our communities, that education is good, but you know what? We've lost something too. We've been chasing the brass ring. We've been going for this white picket fence, and we've lost ourselves.
So the game is not to get into that bourgeoisie class.
The game is empowerment.
Right. But the empowerment isn't to get into that class.
That's right. It's autonomy.
Yeah.
We did a show recently where we spent some time in Detroit, Michigan, and we went around Detroit, and Detroit is so, here's the thing. I see squalor in Chicago. I don't see squalor in Detroit. Detroit is so abandoned. There are no human beings there anymore. It's like a series of books and a documentary that came on a few years ago called Life After Humans, you know, Earth After Humans, mm-hmm. you know. And Detroit looks post-apocalyptic in this sense that there are no human beings to litter the streets. And so you have empty lots everywhere in some places. And maybe one little house that sits on a corner. It looks almost like a Southern house, a house built in the late 18th, early 19th centuries. And then you see prairie growing everywhere in this urban area. And what's happened in Detroit is extraordinary. You know, agricultural endeavors like urban farming and urban ag. It's kind of a latte liberal fad. Oh, let's train people to grow food. No. In Detroit, hundreds of acres. Because, well, if you don't want to do anything with it, say to the city, let us do something with it. City says, I don't care. Go ahead. And there is an urban ag revolution in Detroit. Businesses that are being built. Entrepreneurship. I met a young man who graduated from Michigan State recently, young guy in engineering, and he's running this farm, and he's, you know, running businesses, and he's training other people, and it's extraordinary. And each person I spoke to, it's all about empowerment. Food deserts, my eye. There are no food deserts. We don't need Whole Foods. We don't need Whole Foods here. We'll grow it ourselves. We'll sell it ourselves. We'll cultivate it. You know? And so now they're getting donations from foundations and such who are saying, oh, wow, you're doing this great thing. But it's really getting back to the heart of who we are, you know? And it's in the stereotypes that, oh, if we free these slaves, you know what? They can't take care of themselves. Oh, wait a minute. We built every building here. We cultivated this land. What is the mindset that then says we can't do it for ourselves? No, it's not black failure that is feared. It's black success. What if they can? There were experiments off the coast of Georgia, North Carolina, where they took a group of freed slaves and put them on islands to do, you know, experiments because they wanted to prove that they can't take care of themselves. And they took those lands and multiplied what was being grown there 20-fold because they were working and living for themselves. So these people who are already brilliant, who are already geniuses, who learned how to survive off of the scraps of the pig. You know, we couldn't eat the actual hog. We could eat the head, so hog head cheese we'd make. Or we'd have to eat the intestines. No, chitterlings or chitlins, it's not because, you know, we like that stuff. It's the only choice we had. We'd eat the ears. The hooves. It is amazing how we survived, little or nothing. And then even when we were free, my great-grandfather, Charlie Henry, was a sharecropper. His wife passed away when she was nursing my Uncle Floyd. And now my grandmother was probably 3-4 years old. And now he had to raise 14 children by himself. He did it. He had to move from place to place because the sharecroppers were so unjust that it got to a point where he couldn't even feed his family. I mean, the harvest that he was bringing forth should have fed his family 10 times over. That was our legacy, our story. And we survived. We're here. We didn't take up arms when we were freed as whites were terrified. Oh, if we free them, they're going to take up guns and arms and come after us. We just wanted to be left alone. Just leave us alone. You don't have to give us anything. If you want to give us 40 acres and a meal, great, but just leave us alone. We know how to do this. We'll be fine. It's the interference over time that continues to happen today that is the greatest hindrance. And so the ingenuity is there. We have to train ourselves to get back to that ingenuity. You know, technology should be a tool. And only a tool, and a tool that we evaluate with wisdom in order to benefit all of humankind. Not just some kid in a hoodie gets an idea, and then someone invests in that idea, and then 5 years later, all of humanity or most of humanity are communicating in that mode because some kid in a hoodie had an idea, or that we have self-driving cars and trucks. But yet those self-driving cars and trucks will wipe out the only employment that exists in these poor neighborhoods, black or white, cashiers, drivers. What are they going to do for work? Well, we have to train them. Show me the program. Well, it costs too much. Oh, it costs too much. Our defense budget makes up 57 to 60% of our national budget. You're telling me instead of 57%, we can't spend 55%? And train these people for the future? or 55% instead of 57%, and have universal health care, or if not free schools, subsidized schools? Of course we can. It's our priorities. So I'm put off by so-called moderates who say that we can't do A, B, or C because we cannot pay for it. We seem to find ways to pay for many things when we want to. And so it's time for us, marginalized people, to really begin to stop being so dependent on a system that's set up to serve a few and do the things that our grandparents and great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents did to survive.
It's great to hear all their names. Thanks for beginning by mentioning them.
They are my living saints, and it's a prayer when I speak their names out loud. They speak to me now. I love them so. And now I think of them with joy and no longer with tears. Memory eternal.
Thanks to you.
Thank you for joining us. Racism is a white problem. It is time for those of us who have simply accepted our birthright to talk. Salvation opens to us through confession and accepting the work of repair through which the world becomes new. I welcome your comments on the various themes in this podcast and invite you to visit our website. Contact details may be found in the program notes.